Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. I'm experiencing a really unusual sensation right now. I'm actually feeling kind of anxious about giving the Dhamma talk. Usually, it's not an issue for me, usually. I think partly it's because just feeling under the weather for such a long time, like so many other people have. And the other day, we were doing our Patimokkha chanting, and I was doing beforehand, we have to do all the confessions of any transgressions of the rules that we know we've done, and there's a Pali formula we do it with, and I was doing it with one of the monks, and I kept forgetting where we were in the chant, and it was just like this, my mind was just going completely blank, and it's probably because of all the cough syrup and medications, but so I'm just a little nervous that I do have a subject I kind of want to talk about. Don't want to mislead anybody, so there's a little anxiety. Last Saturday, Ajahn Karunadamo gave a very nurturing talk about meditation practice and kind of guiding us into the meditation retreat. And he pointed out Lumpur's also kind of advice to us at the beginning of, you know, really enjoying the retreat, you know, kind of having that attitude. And I remember at one point Ajahn Karunadamo kind of even did a little just guided meditation of just what it feels like to kind of open up around a meditation subject and to have space. And I just remember just feeling really supported by that guidance. And it reminded me of a Dhamma talk that I heard fairly early on when I started meditating. It was probably within the first couple of years, and it was by Sylvia Borstein that she gave this talk at, I think it was the 20th anniversary, the day of the 20th anniversary of the staff moving into the building in Barre, Massachusetts. And she kind of gave it as a guided meditation, and it was on the seven factors of enlightenment. And she kind of talked about most of the factors, kind of gave a brief explanation, and then for like three or four of them, she led a guided meditation, and I was really struck by it. And right after I heard it, this will date me how old I am, but it was on cassette tapes, and so I got a cassette tape of it and transcribed it, and I probably have it someplace still on a computer somewhere, but several times over the last 20 years, I've actually used it as being at a group. I printed out the section where she does the guided meditation. And I remember three or four years ago, I was at White Salmon, the Pacific Hermitage, and read it out for that. And a lot of people came to me afterwards and were really appreciative. And, you know, I actually went to the website to download her talk. And so it's a pretty good talk. And if anyone's interested, you can download it from Dharma Seed and just look up Sylvia Borstein. And in the search, you can type in just 20th, because it was a 20th anniversary talk, and then it'll come up. And I found it really, you know, also powerful. Sylvia, at least my perception of her is that she's just a very enthusiastic, encouraging kind of person. She's got a personality that's really... And I kind of think of her kind of as a grandmotherly, sweet grandmotherly figure. And so she's, at the beginning of the talk, she's like, it's the 20th anniversary, and they had this party in the staff room, which is just like a wall away from where all these, I think it's probably the long-term, three-month retreat, people are doing this retreat. And she's like, you know, we had a debate, you know, should we actually have a party just on the other side of this wall over here where, you know, all the meditators are on the other side? And she said, we talked about it and decided, yes, we should. And those that hear us, they'll be experiencing mudita. And of course, everybody starts laughing. And she said, and for any of you that didn't, you know, hear about the, didn't hear the party, I'm telling you about it now. So now you can experience mudita. So she just has this really playful kind of attitude. And I've always thought that it'd be kind of fun to, you know, sort of take that type of theme, like the seven factors of enlightenment, and actually kind of work it into my own Dhamma talk. And so, you know, after hearing Ajahn Karunadamo give his talk, I thought about it and sort of listened to her talk again and did a bunch of reading. And one thing I noticed was is I've always had the way that Sylvia gave the talk was very, I'd say, untraditional in the way that, like, the factors are spelled out. She starts off with talking about concentration, and then leading from concentration, she talks about the factor of piti, or rapture, and then she goes through all these, I forget the exact sequence, but it's very not the sort of traditional way that I've always read about it or the way I think about it. And so, but I was, you know, contemplating the way she did it, and it makes sense in the fact that it's like she's talking to people who are doing a long-term meditation retreat, and, you know, starting with concentration is probably, you know, something that they're there, have been doing, that they can have some understanding of. And then, you know, from the factors that come up, you know, can lead into, say, you know, rapture, and then, you know, say, calm, and, you know, the factors of the sequence she went through kind of made sense. But so I thought, you know, if it's something that I would do as a guided meditation, it's probably something I would need to spend more time contemplating and thinking about. So I'm not really gonna do that tonight. But I do want to eventually come around to talk about them, and at least sort of the introduction, and talk about mindfulness. That's partly why I did the mindfulness of breathing sutta this at the beginning of the session. Yeah, because there it does talk about sort of mindfulness of breathing, you know, when cultivated and fulfilled, you know, is, you know, sort of is the fulfillment of the four foundations of mindfulness. And then the four foundations of mindfulness are the sort of culmination of the seven factors of enlightenment. And then these seven factors of enlightenment, if they're cultivated and developed, will lead to, you know, liberation, you know, understanding, and release. And also, I was thinking about this. Thursday, we had a building committee meeting, and we were not necessarily joking, but I think Debbie brought up there's this kind of formula. It's either 90-10 or 80-20. I always think of it as 80-20. And it's that like the last 20% of a building project takes 80% of the time to complete. And so we're so close to getting this new building here finished. And but yet, if you go through every single room, there's not a single room that's finished yet. And it's kind of daunting, even if you go through each room, like, okay, what still needs to be done? What contractors need to be here to finish it? And I just was thinking the one room that's probably closest to being finished is one we didn't even think we were going to finish, which is the storage room in the basement. I think it needs one more coat of paint, and then it'll be the first room that's done. And which is kind of ironic for one of the points I'm going to make later here. When we were talking about this, you know, it was kind of a casual comment, this is the 80-20 rule. And Wayne Pashore, who's one of the committee members, and he's probably also one of the kind of unsung heroes of this whole project. Is Wayne kind of a, like, consultant or
project manager?
Project manager, yeah. And so he's been a building inspector, and he's a builder, and so we hire him to, you know, look after it and give us advice. And so, like, when everybody else on the committee, you know, thinks we should paint something, Wayne knows that we should paint it and gives us the advice and tells us, you know, what the options are. And if he doesn't know, he knows the people that can get us the answers. So he's been this real quite valuable committee member. And when Debbie made that comment about the 90-10, he's made the innocent comment that really struck me. And it's the comment was that the two hardest parts of a building project is beginning it and ending it. The two hardest parts are beginning it and ending it. And that got me thinking about, you know, our meditation and the spiritual life. You know, it's like a big step for, you know, everybody to, you know, everybody here, everybody who's listening to this talk. You know, we've begun the process. We've started that building project. And I've thought about this in a couple of ways that it came up that are kind of profound for me. And, you know, one is like, you know, our building project. Is the building project really for Nibbana? Is it really to understand dukkha, to understand anicca and anatta, to really, to understand the stress and its causes and how to let go of that? Is that really our building project? Or is it just a home fixer-upper? You know, is it just we have a little bit of, you know, flaw, not a little bit, but we have flaws in our personalities that, you know, I just want to be a little nicer, I just want to be a little more at peace, or, you know, less of a nuisance to other people. And, you know, it brings up the question, you know, like, what is our project? And, you know, there's no right or wrong with that, but just what is, just coming to terms with that, with ourselves. And, you know, whatever that that building project is, it's like, you know, have we thought it through? Do we have a building committee? You know, do we have trusted people that we can go to for advice, can give us the instructions, and, you know, the people that we trust for, you know, their quality of work? And, you know, have we started? And then that also brings up the second part of the equation then for me is the, you know, like, well, why haven't we finished? And so, you know, looking at this building project out here, it's a, you know, we are in this, the last, you know, just the last 20% of it. And you can see that there's just infinite details of, you know, things that we could get lost into. You know, it's like, you know, I've heard the analogy here of, like, you know, sanding a piece of wood, you know, like on the shrine in the new hall. It's like, yeah, it's really appropriate for that piece of wood to have, you know, been taken down, sanding it all the way down to like 2,000 grit sandpaper, you know, starting off with the 80 grit and then going to the 150 and the 220 and then the 500. And, you know, you can just continually refine. And in certain applications, that's appropriate. But if you're doing a faux beam that's, you know, 25 feet in the air, you know, do you really need to take that sandpaper down to 2,000 grit? You can, but it, you know, we start, you get focused in on the details, but kind of see the bigger perspective. It can be not necessarily a waste of time, but may not be needed. You know, just thinking about it, like, you know, like we could go into the Dhamma hall and to the new reception hall and where the maple paneling's up, and you can always find, you know, a board that, you know, maybe has a knot in it that isn't attractive, and, you know, we could spend immense amount of time sort of trying to perfect everything and, you know, making it exactly as we want. And, you know, if we do that, we'll never get the job done. And so the same can happen in our meditation practice. You know, we might start go down these, you know, sort of side tracks that maybe are interesting, they are, you know, energizing and finding satisfaction and reward in them. But they, you know, they may, you know, that kind of process, you know, we can see can just go on forever. There can be no ending to that. And so it's, you know, to me, it's just like, look at that, like, yeah, why, you know, if we do have a clear goal in process, you know, are we going in the right direction? Are we putting our efforts where they really need to be put? And again, there's no judgment, but to me, it's just an interesting question. Just coming up from that, yeah, you know, it's the two hardest parts are starting it and finishing it. And you can often, you know, I question too, like, you know, is there a fear about finishing? Is there, you know, it's an unknown, or, you know, or do we just get comfortable? Like, yeah, it's interesting too. It's like that whole process of, So like the beginning and the ending are the hard parts, but like, you know, what we're doing now, we're in the middle, this is the easy part. And so it can feel comfortable to be on retreat, to live in a monastic community where people are trustworthy, where people support us, you know, want to be here. That can be very comforting and not always easy, but this is the good part. And so we can kind of get lulled into a false satisfaction. So coming back to the, you know, the cultivating and the having the roadmap, you know, again, looking at, for me, the seven factors of enlightenment, the way that, well, a couple of years ago during the winter retreat, we took the fourth Satipatthana and we're going through it, and I did volunteer to do some presentations on the seven factors of enlightenment, and you know, was reading Bhante Gunaratna's book on the on these factors, and the way he teaches it, and from many people that I've seen, they teach it this way, that there is sort of a natural unfolding of these factors, and it starts with mindfulness, and then from mindfulness leads to Dhammavicaya, which is investigation, which I thought was really kind of interesting. I was already planning on giving this talk, but that was the talk, the main theme of Ajahn Chah's reading that we did today. So it's Dhammavicaya, investigation, and then the next one is Virya, energy. And then from energy leads to piti, or kind of sometimes like a rapture. And then pasati, which is oftentimes translated as calm or tranquility, then leads to samadhi, concentration. Ajahn Jayasaro has been translating it as a lucid calm, which we've, a lot of us here kind of like that translation. And then leads to, from concentration, leads to equanimity. And Bhante Gunaratna really spells it out really beautifully, that if you really sort of developing the mindfulness factor, and you really kind of cultivate it till it's a enlightenment factor, then that leads to sort of Dhammavicaya. It's naturally kind of on its own. And then when you sort of bring your attention to, say, investigation, then it's like, he says, you know, well, what do you need to, it kind of starts off with, like, if you're working with mindfulness practice and you really want to perfect it, what you have to do is you have to start investigating. Like, you know, what is it about, you start investigating the three characteristics and kind of seeing how things are changing, how things are stressful, and how things aren't really a permanent self. And that kind of investigation helps you to purify the mindfulness. And then when that sort of gets fully developed, then you get even more energy to investigate. And so then you start investigating, and usually it's kind of classified as like you start investigating the five aggregates, looking at the body and start looking at the mental states. And so when you start investigating, it brings up energy, or how you perfect the investigation is to look at, is looking at the energy that's sort of, you know, that leads, that's wholesome energy versus sort of like scattered or energy that you know, takes you away from investigation. And so through working with energy, then that perfects the quality of investigation. And so then when that sort of does become perfected, then at that point you say your mindfulness is really strong, your investigation is really strong, and then when that really, both of those two kind of makes the energy really kind of peaceful and calm and steady, so then that leads into the piti, which is say often translated as rapture, kind of a heightened sense of bodily awareness. And so then the sort of rapture is the calming aspect of that leads to a pasati, which is the tranquility. One of these is more of a physical quality and one's more of a mental quality. So you, the both the body and the mind have started to settle down. And then when the when both of those have calmed and settled, then you that leads into concentration. And then the concentration is purified. Then that leads to you see things quite clearly. And that leads to the equanimity. So there's a sort of process of where they, one leads into the other. And actually the one that you're, the next one in the series is actually what you use to sort of purify the one that you're working on. At the beginning of the sutta, there's a translation by Bhikkhu Bodhi that says, he's sort of talking about, how do you get started with the cultivation of mindfulness? And the phrase goes something like, a meditator, it's in the suttas, it's a bhikkhu, he uses bhikkhu, so I'll probably try to use that, but it's anybody who's meditating, and I'll say he, but it could be she as well. So, but, when a bhikkhu starts contemplating the body as a body, ardent, fully aware and mindful, having put away covetousness and grief for the world, say on that occasion, then the mindfulness becomes unremitting. But then when the mindfulness becomes unremitting, say on that occasion, then it becomes a factor of mindfulness as a factor of awakening. But in that stage, it's just the arising of it as a factor of enlightenment. So then the bhikkhu will develop it and then bring it to fulfillment. And so there's a lot of information in this that opening statement of how to develop mindfulness and so Bhikkhu Bodhi also mentions, or Monte Gunaratta mentions at the end of that it starts off with the body and the body, but it can also be feeling and feeling, the mind and the mind, or phenomena and phenomena. So it's the four, any of the subjects of the Satipatthana, any meditation object we're bringing up, those are valid. It's not just contemplation of the body or contemplation of the breath. And the first thing this points to is that mindfulness needs an object. It's like we can't just sort of come into the hall and say, okay, I'm just gonna practice mindfulness and just try to open up to everything that happens in the universe. But it's very specifically choosing a topic and holding ourselves sort of accountable or bringing that up for reflection. And so it needs to be very specific. And then also this, it being ardent, fully aware and mindful, to me that really shows that there's a doing involved in the meditation. I think for myself, there's this tendency of kind of wanting just to not have to do anything. I just want to get into a deep state of concentration. So it's like vibhava tanha, not wanting to exist. But real progress is going to happen when we're fully engaged with the meditation. One of the passages we read today from Ajahn Chah, he didn't stress it the first part, but he went into quite more detail in the second part. But he said, there's two different types of meditators in general. And the first type is those that, say, can focus in on and get fairly concentrated and can sort of, drop the proliferating mind. There's only one line he said about that. But for that type of person, oftentimes contemplating is quite difficult because they can drop the thinking mind quite easily. And then they can go into also a very dull state. And so it's more difficult for that person to develop wisdom. Whereas somebody who has more difficulty sort of quieting the mind, they have work to do. And so cultivating and working with the mind, and if they are able to see into, say, the impermanence and the changing nature and how it's unsatisfactory, there's a real chance there to develop some wisdom. And so, looking at it, it's not necessarily, getting into deep states of concentration is a good or bad thing, or if that you can't get into deep states of concentration, that doesn't necessarily need to be a good or a bad thing either. It's just kind of knowing that that's our temperament. But it's interesting, because Ajahn Chah, I think, spent more time focusing on that aspect of if you're someone who doesn't get very concentrated, but if we are somebody who it's really quite an easy thing for us to do, you know, to pay attention to that. But yeah, what are we doing with that concentration? What are we doing with the kind of the power of that samadhi? Are we doing anything with it? So then the next part of the initial statement was that, you know, having put away covetousness and grief for the world. And so, you know, that I think that, you know, kind of points out to that, I think it also points to like the hindrances, you know, having abandoned the hindrances and, you know, having that stability of mind to be able to focus in on our meditation object. And it's, you know, having put away, say, the covetousness and grief of the world, that's, you know, not just during our meditation, but, you know, trying to do that all the time, trying to, you know, not to pick up subjects to, you know, to kind of get distracted in our meditation. And that was one of the other themes that Ajahn Chah was talking about, that I never heard anybody talk about it quite so clear, but where he was saying that, you know, when we get into a state of calm in our meditation, that if something does come up naturally to investigate, and, you know, we have this tendency to think that that's wrong. You know, like we came in to be quiet in the meditation, or we had reached a place of calm and tranquility, and then something comes in to disturb that meditation, and so, you know, we can kind of resist it and push it away and not want to contemplate it, because thinking that's disturbing the calm. But Ajahn Chah was pointing out that that's actually not the case, that if you are calm and something comes up that needs to be looked at, or, you know, wants to be looked at, that is actually happening within the calm, not to be feared, not to be pushed away. And so there's certain, you know, we're talking about it, like it's tricky to know, like when it's a, say, proliferation, when it's you know, this the thinking part of the mind, you know, versus, you know, coming from the calm part of the mind. And so I think part of this is, you know, having put away covetousness and grief for the world. So it's like looking at the kind of quality of those thoughts and where they're coming from. And I noticed in myself, was talking about that a little bit this morning, was that, you know, sometimes I will be quite calm, and then all of a sudden I'll want to, this part of the mind sort of kicks in and thinks, oh, I should be doing something. I should be, you know, I should do this type of meditation or do that type of meditation. And often if it's coming from, like, say, unwise attention, it's just sprung up and, like, there was a lack of mindfulness when that initial thought came in, then it might try to pick it up and start running away with it and start working with it. But oftentimes when that happens, it's not very pleasant. It's not, doesn't lead to clarity or to more calm states of mind. And so, you know, as soon as I can catch that, then I can, okay, yeah, no, wait, this isn't coming from clarity. This isn't really something that needs to be contemplated, or what needs to be contemplated is maybe, like, you know, where was the lack of mindfulness, or how would you strengthen that mindfulness? And partly it's just practice and just going back to the meditation, the whatever was doing, mindfulness of breathing. And then what Bhante Ji really, really focuses in on this kind of statement is that, you know, he says that, you know, once we have developed our mindfulness practice, say mindfulness of breathing, then, you know, we get to a point where it's you know, we're doing it pretty consistently. He says unremittingly, and then his definition of that is like 24 hours a day, you know, like you are able to stay with your meditation object, all of your waking part of the day. And he said at that point, and it's stated in the suttas, that the mindfulness factor of enlightenment is sort of aroused. So it's not even perfected as an enlightenment factor at that point, but it's been sort of awakened. It's starting to it is going to become, I think, become like more and more prevalent in your life and in your daily practice. When I was doing these, the readings a couple of years ago on the seven factors, I was reading a sutta though for Sariputta, and he's already fully enlightened, and he makes the comment, he says, you know, in the morning, you know, whatever of these seven factors that I choose to, you know, put my mind, you know, on, you know, I dwell on that for the morning, and whichever one I put my mind on in the afternoon, you know, that's where I dwell. He says, but if the factor disappears on me, I just know that it's disappeared. It's abated in me, and I know the cause of why it's abated in me. And so, you know, even for someone like, you know, Venerable Sariputta is, you know, fully enlightened and the chief disciple of the Buddha, even though, you know, he is contemplating or practicing with these seven factors, even for him, there's causes and conditions for why they do arise. And I think I heard Ajahn Pasano's voice in the background, you know, pointing out with that it's, you know, that these factors, they're not permanent. They're impermanent as well. And so they arise due to causes and they abate due to causes. And so, you know, in this initial stage, it's, you know, I think Bhante G is really pointing to is like, yeah, it needs to be a really ardent, you know, fully committed practice to developing mindfulness. And I don't think of it as like, you know, gritting your teeth and pressing your tongue against the roof of your mouth and, you know, stressing out. But it's just, you know, kind of realizing that, yeah, this is going to lead to the happier states of mind. This is going to be, if I don't want to get caught up in, you know, habitual, whatever our home improvement project is, if we want to, you know, sort of improve that, overcome that, it's going to be overcome by developing mindfulness. And so, you know, as we start getting some confidence and success with that, then it becomes easier and we want to do it. We will see that that is the way to overcome that. And then, even then, once this, the way this, the sutta continues then is that, you know, once it's even aroused, then the bhikkhu cultivates it, still works with it, still develops that. And then, you know, through that continual development, then it comes to fulfillment. And then it's interesting, it's like, then he says that, you know, when, so you think, okay, wow, mindfulness is, you know, completely, you know, developed as an enlightenment factor. But he says, then that is what the cause is then for then real investigation starts to come up when you really purify the mindfulness. And then you go through that, you're starting to look at it. You already have been, you've been actually using all of the seven factors the whole time we've been meditating. But then, you know, that mindfulness then really helps to purify the investigation, which then purifies the energy, which purifies the PT and the paucity and this concentration or lucid calm and equanimity. So they all build on each other. And see, I do like the way Sylvia though kind of taught them as well. Is that I couldn't find the sutta, but I'm pretty sure there was one that I had read where you know, not all of the you know, going you know, we don't need to think of it in terms of, you know, developing each one of these sequentially. Like, oh no, I can't work on concentration until I've developed you know, pause, until I'm tranquil. You know, it's like, yeah, we can bring up each one individually and explore it and understand it. And it's actually, it's not even, let's say, appropriate to be in all of the different factors or be in certain factors at certain times. Like if we're extremely anxious or, you know, really fearful or, you know, there's a lot of energy in our body, well, it's probably not the factor of energy that you want to bring up and cultivate or to be thinking about. You want to have some familiarity, some understanding of tranquility practice or concentration practices, and that might be the better place for us to put our mind. Or if we're the first meditation right after the meal, you know, probably tranquility and concentration wouldn't be the best meditations to do. We probably need to bring up investigation or we need to bring up energy. Those would probably be the more appropriate. And I remember this teaching because the Buddha said though that the one factor that is always appropriate is mindfulness. So like in any situation, mindfulness is always appropriate. So I'll just leave these few thoughts for contemplation.